Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Live Your Art. That's North Carolina A&T State University alumna and producing artistic director Hilda Willis's fondest wish for you. She's made it work for multi-platinum singer-songwriter, recording artist India Arie, and she can make it work for you if you've got what it takes. Legendary jazz musician John Coltrane certainly had what it took and then some. His hometown of High Point salutes the late great saxophone master every year with the International Jazz and Blues Festival in his name. This year's lineup is out, it's hot, and we'll share it with you today on the show. Preservation Greensboro's Benjamin Briggs shares the magic of historic Blandwood Mansion with us, and music scholars Tim Sharp and Scott Carpenter take us on a magical Moravian musical tour. We'll get romantic with pianist Peter Karoff and dive headfirst into the world of books with author Charlie Lovett next after this news. Live Your Art, producing artistic director Hilda Willis, has been coaching performers on their artistic development and the business of showbiz for decades. The North Carolina A&T State University alumna has a Rolodex of current and former clients that's a veritable who's who of superstars, including India Arie, Jane Fonda, and Michael Bolton. Hilda spoke with me by phone from her home in Atlanta, Georgia, about how she does what she does so well.
Being able to identify not just their goal, but helping them look at a strategic plan, understanding what is the standard in practice, what's the conventional wisdom, where are you in your understanding of that, how much of it works for you, how much of it doesn't, and learning who you are, what it is you want. Do you have a mission and vision for your work? If we're talking about longevity, I challenge artists, and I deal with artists in every domain, literary, visual, as well as performing artists. So I'm looking for you to demonstrate to me that you're in this for the long haul. Your shelf life is your life. Looking to see that an artist understands the art of negotiating, understanding their value, understanding that it takes more than just them, that so many people have already contributed to their success before they step on the stage or pick up an instrument or whatever it is that they're doing, and really taking the time to understand how these pieces come into play. Because ultimately, you need a team of people that you can trust, that you know their level of competency. And so really, in order to do that successfully, in my opinion, you have to have at least a working knowledge. Wow. And so usually the artists that I end up working with are the ones that are open to understanding who they are and the business of art. I tend not to just work with artists who are only interested in their artistic development and how do I get to this level, and I really am not interested in anything else. I'm usually not the person for that type of artist. I believe in a holistic approach, and that's what works for me.
I'm drawn to the kind of the parallels between some of the establishment things and laying out a clear framework for success and really putting together a business plan.
Yes. Your body is your instrument. That's the institution. You're the commodity. Let's be clear about it.
Yeah, why talk around it? It seems like there's so many amazing artists in every discipline you just outlined there. What separates that really good singer, actor, actress from the superstar? What is that? Can you go there with me, Hilda, and try to place your finger on that intangible, or are they that intangible at all?
That is a great question, David. I believe that it depends on how a person learns, how hungry you are. I tell artists all the time, I think you're hungry for a snack, and that's okay. You can be hungry for a snack, but if you really want that stardom, whatever that stardom is for you, because I don't necessarily define success as rich and famous, but let's go there. Most artists do. They imagine that they're successful because they're rich and famous, and so oftentimes they don't think about what they're giving up for that. But the bottom line is you have to believe in yourself more than the collective disbelief. To me, that's the difference. You have to be hungry for the entire course. I don't know if it's 7 courses, is it 5 courses, but you really have to be that hungry for it, and you have to be relentless. 80% of most successful artists, beyond artists, pick any industry, is no. But particularly for an artist, you're going to hear a lot more no's than you're going to hear yeses. And are you doing the work? Are you in the woodshed? Are you cutting your teeth? Are you getting yourself in a position where when your opportunity comes, you're ready? It's not about, oh, well, you see, I ran out of business cards. You have to be ready. You don't know where your opportunity is going to come. So the excuses, the, well, I thought, and see, that's laziness. That's a particular kind of laziness to me. When you want it, you get prepared for it, and you stay in that ready position because you don't know where the opportunity is going to come from.
That, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot my business card today. That ain't going to wash with Hilda.
No, I mean, well, you know, if you come to me for coaching, I do an assessment to see where you are. Okay, and then I say, you know what? I don't coach everyone that comes to me. I don't have a shingle. I don't advertise. I only work by referral, whether I'm working with a nationally known artist or community artist, an emerging artist, just like the students at North Carolina A&T. Do an assessment. This is what I'm saying you need to have in place before you come back here. There are times I'll meet with people and say, actually, you're not ready for coaching. This is where I see you are. Let me make these kinds of recommendations. Sometimes I have to give people homework. If they don't come back with the homework, I'm not going to waste my time because I don't know how to do 50% of coaching. If I give you 100% and you only give or put in 50, you're only going to get a 50% result. So I only want to work with people who are hungry, who want to dig in, who want to figure it out and look at all the things that are in the way and say, ah, this is my hit list. Let me start eliminating these things.
I can't think of a better example of someone who fits that mold than the woman I just got finished speaking with, India Irie. And you have a 15-year relationship with her, really crafting a career and developing it into what it is today. Could you talk to a few of the things that you all have focused on throughout the course of that development?
I would say that my first discipline was music, but the thing that helped me come into my own as an artist and as a human being was theater. And I think that theater is the greatest of all of the art disciplines when it comes to helping get to the truth and telling your own authentic story. And when you can support an artist in identifying what their truth is and then helping them to manifest that truth through whatever their medium is, see, I think that that's what's most helpful. I don't know what a person's truth is, but I can help them find their truth. And then what's the safest and strongest way to convey that? Because taking a stand on a belief that's connected to your experience makes a greater impact than taking a stand on something that you simply read or someone told you about.
Not the average girl from your video. My worth is not determined by the price of my clothes. No matter what I'm wearing, I can always be.
My thanks to artistic developer and career coach Hilda Willis. Hilda is the creative director for Soulbird Music, producing artistic director for Living Your Art, and executive artistic director of the Performing Arts Program for Youth in Atlanta, Georgia. She spoke with me by phone from her home there. For more than 15 years, Hilda has been the creative director and life coach for Grammy Award-winning and four-time NAACP Image Award honoree India Irie. Last spring, India gave a concert at her performance coach's alma mater in Harrison Auditorium on the campus of North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. You'll find links to Live Your Art on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll also find the latest from India Irie there. Cocoa Butter is the first single from her upcoming album, Song Versation, available June 25th. I'm David Ford. The John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival in High Point recently unveiled its 2013 lineup, and it's a doozy with saxophonist Dave Cause and friends, singer Al Jarreau, and trumpeter Christian Scott, just to name a few. It's the third annual festival in honor of one of the triad's most famous native sons. Legendary saxophonist John Coltrane sits among the likes of Charlie Parker and Miles Davis as one of the most influential musicians in the history of jazz, and his impact on the art form continues worldwide to this day. Coltrane's boyhood home was High Point, North Carolina, where he attended William Penn High School, now Penn Griffin School for the Arts, and played in the school band. He also grew up hearing music of the Black Church. His maternal grandfather, the Reverend William Blair, was a preacher at an African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in High Point, and his paternal grandfather, Reverend William Coltrane, was an AME Zion minister in Hamlet, North Carolina, where John was born in 1926. The great jazz tradition in our state continues, and four of today's leading jazz musicians, who each call the triad home, share a moment to reflect on Coltrane's life and legacy. In this sound portrait, we'll hear University of North Carolina Greensboro Associate Professors bassist Steve Haynes and saxophonist Chad Eby, trumpeter and North Carolina A&T State University Professor Mondre Moffitt, and Executive Director of the North Carolina Jazz Repertory Orchestra and Music Director for the John Coltrane Jazz Workshop in High Point, saxophonist Wally West.
His family moved to Philadelphia when Coltrane was a senior in high school, but it wasn't long after that he decided that he wanted to be a musician. He was taking classes at music schools and things like that. There's a recording that exists of this Navy band in 1946 out in Hawaii when he was right around 20 years old. I think it was just short of his 20th birthday. Coltrane's initial recording output there doesn't really hold up. He actually sounds like he's having a really hard time. He got an opportunity to go on the road with Johnny Hodges' small group when Hodges had divorced himself from Duke Ellington for about 5 years. Now, the difference between John Coltrane there in the early to mid-1950s, it was 1954 where we actually have a recording of that band, the difference between Coltrane at that point and the Coltrane of 1946 is overwhelming.
He was what we know in the industry as a practice hound. If he was awake and wasn't eating and wasn't gigging, he was practicing.
Coltrane was deeply concerned with trying to find a way that he could purge himself spiritually through music, and he knew that only by getting the saxophone out of his way, in other words, by practicing it to the point where anything was possible, he would then be able to exude himself spiritually through the music.
In 1957, he had a terrible heroin addiction, and he fought that. He got clean and had what I suppose folks would call a religious experience, where he relearned the grace of God. And ultimately, what he was scratching at was he wanted to feel and understand and hear and play God as if he was a vessel. And by doing so, he would bring happiness and joy to the world. And naturally, he did that.
The Giant Steps is one of those ones that I think you practice that song until you die and hope to be able to play it as well as John Coltrane ever did. Giant Steps is one of those songs that has harmonic complexity, and it is centered around several key centers, and the complex chord progression that he wrote for this later became known as Coltrane Changes.
I loved about John Coltrane was his phase that he did avant-garde music and came back home with the spirituality in the 60s with his focus, of course, with the Love Supreme.
He goes completely a different direction and minimalizes just about everything he's doing. Pretty soon, instead of improvising through keys, they're improvising over tonal centers or single pitches, and just being driven by melody rather than being driven by harmony. And this is sort of tied into the music of Ornette Coleman, who was always guided by melody and less so by specific harmony.
You know, my dad was part of the Ornette Coleman trio. He played drums with Ornette Coleman. And John Coltrane was studying with Ornette during the time that my dad was in the group. So I have some very intimate and close-up look at Coltrane's quest for excellence and going outside the box. And once he discovered this avant-garde aspect of it, he thought that he could bring in more of his philosophy and more of his spiritual values, even more so in the music.
And that sort of defines the rest of Coltrane's career, including his, you know, arguably his greatest masterpiece, A Love Supreme, in 1964, which is essentially long vamps of one chord or two chords or a very sort of subtly modified blues.
The acknowledgement with A Love Supreme, that four-note theme, He plays that in every key, which Lewis Porter believes is John Coltrane's way of saying that God is everywhere. But the emotional aspect of A Love Supreme, the depth of A Love Supreme, the depth in groove, the depth in melody, the tenacious forward propulsion of the rhythm section, the complete focus that they have of clear melody, it's really, really something spectacular, and to me, his greatest triumph.
University of North Carolina Greensboro associate professors bassist Steve Haynes and saxophonist Chad Eby, trumpeter and North Carolina A&T State University professor Mondre Moffitt, and executive director of the North Carolina Jazz Repertory Orchestra and music director for the John Coltrane Jazz Workshop in High Point, saxophonist Wally West. They paid tribute to North Carolina native John Coltrane. Coltrane grew up in High Point, and it'll be there on Saturday, August 31st, in Oak Hollow Festival Park, that the third annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival will be held. The 2013 lineup is out, with headliners Al Jarreau, Dave Cause, Christian Scott, and more, and you'll find links to ticket information on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up on the show, we'll travel back through time and visit one of Greensboro's most celebrated historic homes. Preservation Greensboro's Benjamin Briggs will be our tour guide through the house begun in the backcountry way back in 1795, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Pianist Peter Karoff is back with a user-friendly look at the Romantic era in music. Bethany Chafin talks up local author Charlie Lovett. Charlie used to sell antiquarian books, but his own new novel is being given a hearty thumbs up by none other than Barnes & Noble. And coming up in just a bit, it's antiquarian Moravian music. We'll trace the song migration of our founding fathers with Old Salem's Scott Carpenter. Preservation Greensboro's Blandwood Mansion, constructed by Charles Bland, is one of America's truly great historic homes. It represents the ideals of progressive North Carolina Governor John Motley Moorhead, and it serves as a prototype for one of America's most popular architectural styles in the 19th century. Blandwood is considered the oldest standing example of Italianate architecture in the United States. Today, Blandwood operates as a museum and provides visitors with a remarkably complete ensemble of 19th century art, architecture, furnishings, and landscape, and in 1988, it received the distinction of being named a National Historic Landmark. You and your entire family can experience this remarkable building and grounds this Sunday, June 2nd, when members of Preservation Greensboro are invited to attend Kids Day at Blandwood. Bring a friend to this event on the grounds of Blandwood Mansion. Members can enjoy gelato, games on the lawn, arts and crafts activities, music, and fun for kids of all ages. Membership begins at just $15 for students, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Preservation Greensboro Executive Director Benjamin Briggs shares a little of what you'll find at Blandwood.
The earliest portion of the house was built on the backcountry in 1795, and it was simply two rooms up and two rooms down. The cooking fireplace was inside the biggest room in the house, so you had a big fireplace with all the pots and the culinary obstacle course that people put in front of things. They might be storing tools inside the hall. One of the kids might be having a bath. I mean, it would be sort of mayhem to our eyes. But as time went by and the Piedmont began to gentrify and to become a little less of a backcountry, the requirements changed with that house, and specialized spaces were sought. So the first owner that bought the house in the 1820s made an addition to it. He wanted his own private master bedroom and some sort of a formal space. So they built a one room up and one room down addition just to get a little space to divide that chaos that was going on in that house. And that was all well and good. And he sold the house to his son-in-law, which was Governor Moorhead. Governor Moorhead additionally sought to specialize even more spaces. He was a gregarious man. He obviously is governor. He had lots of friends all across the eastern seaboard. And his requirements for a home were to have some entertaining spaces and meeting spaces. So that's what he brought A.J. Davis in to do, was to provide some formal rooms in the house and some guest rooms for all the people that were coming to stay with him. And that's what A.J. Davis did. He designed a very grand receiving hall. Interestingly, he divided that space up so that the staircase to the upper private levels of the house were screened behind doors, because this was a public building, and Mrs. Moorhead didn't want people wandering up the stairs and getting into the private areas of the house. So they closed their private area of the house off. That's one thing that's different. You know, normally when you walk into an old house, you immediately see the grand staircase. Blandwood has none because Mrs. Moorhead wanted private areas private and the public areas public. But with those public rooms, Davis really excelled. He threw in all his bells and whistles. He designed amazing cast plaster ceilings, which are likely the most elaborate plaster ceilings in antebellum North Carolina. I can't think of anything that rivals with indigenous plants such as wood ferns, woodland ferns, and scuppernong vines wrapping around the middle of the ceiling and around the perimeter.
Would all the craftspeople involved in that have been from the United States, or they'd have to import them as well from Europe?
We're not exactly sure. We know that the contractors were from Lexington, North Carolina, but I imagine that a lot of the painters and the plasterers probably had to be imported from other places. And Davis threw in other tricks as well. He didn't have double-hung windows. He had casement windows that slid sideways like a sliding door into the pockets, into the walls.
And that was unique for this state.
That was probably the first time that that had ever been in the state. But Davis saw it as just a utilitarian way to deal with windows. And on top of that, he installed wooden blinds also that slid back into cavities in the walls so that you could, for example, during the heat of the summer, slide the glass window in the open position, slide the louvered blind into the closed position, and you could still get some airflow, but privacy. So there were some innovations like that that are actually rare survivors within all of Davis's work up and down the East Coast. We're one of the only places where that element survives. Another area that he was foresightful in was letting natural light in the house. So we have lots of windows, and we have bay windows on the east and west side of the house that admit lots of natural light. And he even had French doors installed with mirrored glass in them, trimmed with a little bit of gold leaf in order to reflect the last rays of sun in the evenings when he might be entertaining. As the sun set in the western sky, it would shine in through the west-facing windows and reflect off the mirrored glass and just provide a little extra light for evening events.
Wow.
So all these are features that still survive. They're original. We have the original mirror doors, even the gold gilding and marble mantles, which were novel in central North Carolina at that time. All of that still survives in Blandwood. So it is a remarkable survivor for the Piedmont.
Amazing.
And don't forget, there's a three-story tower on the front of Blandwood. They could open up the windows on the third floor of the top of the tower and create sort of a vacuum through the house as the wind passed by to really pull the breeze through the house. So in the evenings, once it did cool down, open the windows in the tower, and it was a cooling mechanism.
An updraft.
That's exactly right. Sort of like a chimney. It just created a draft. And so if you had a window open somewhere else in the house, it would draw the air through.
So far we've been talking about Blandwood in terms of the architectural nature of it, and it was almost Jeffersonian, some of the implements that A.J. Davis brought in terms of the window construction. But within that, it's a piece of art on the interior too.
Well, we're very fortunate with Blandwood to have a high degree of authentic furnishings and artwork in the house, and that is because in the 1960s, when the house was being pursued for development into a museum, nobody wanted the Victorian furniture. And the scale of the furniture built for Blandwood was something that didn't fit into people's New York apartment flat. So everybody was all too happy to get rid of it. So as the women in Greensboro began to go around and solicit donations of furniture for Blandwood, it was relatively easy for them to get a lot of the original furnishings back. They just didn't fit, and they weren't very trendy at the time. So we have elements like the governor's bed, the governor's desk, his easy chair, the entire settee in the parlor, the dining room furniture. All of that is original material and much more. Even the cradle that the governor was in as a baby, all of that still exists in the house. We also have a great collection of art in the house. Some of the paintings in the house were actually done in Greensboro by an artist by the name of Friedrichs, who was from the Flanders area of Europe. And he was an influential artist because he brought the Hudson River movement, which was the first in the United States and arguably in the world to really begin to focus on the grandeur of natural environments. So Friedrichs would go out into the mountains of North Carolina and the Piedmont, and he would paint pictures of waterfalls and cattle on the fields and mountain ranges and forests and people skating and the winter scenes, really capturing natural beauty. And we're very fortunate to have some Friedrichs because a warehouse full of his paintings burned in Greensboro in the 1920s, and most of his work was lost.
Preservation Greensboro Executive Director Benjamin Briggs. Today, Blandwood operates as a museum and provides visitors with a remarkably complete ensemble of 19th century art, architecture, furnishings, and landscape. You and your entire family can experience this remarkable building and grounds this Sunday, June 2nd, during Kids Day at Blandwood. Preservation Greensboro members can enjoy gelato, games on the lawn, arts and crafts activities, music, and fun for kids of all ages. This is a free event for members of Preservation Greensboro and their friends. If you're not yet a member but would like to attend, Preservation Greensboro membership begins at just $15 for students, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Last April, Old Salem Museum and Gardens and the Moravian Music Foundation celebrated the life of Moravian pastor, bishop, composer, musician, scholar, and educator Johannes Erbst by planning a three-day symposium at Old Salem. One of the guest lecturers slated to speak was Dr. Tim Sharp, executive director of the American Choral Directors Association. He dropped by along with Old Salem organist and coordinator of music programming Scott Carpenter to shed some light on this fascinating Renaissance man. This attraction to his music, where did that begin?
Well, it was really the song migration in our colonial days between Europe and our founding fathers, and literally our political founding fathers, our founding cities, and that Moravian connection when these Germans were bringing over the finest from the court and the finest from the church that they were modeling and bringing their, literally, their instruments and bringing their music with them and performing those same things in our communities here in Salem and in the Pennsylvania community. So for me, this was sort of the building blocks of what becomes an American voice, but it's a migration voice from Europe first. They were performing the first performances of Messiah and the creation on this soil. While we were still building log cabins, they were doing that kind of high-quality literature. So it's a natural beginning point for anybody interested in, you know, the American choral music scene.
I've always found that interesting how oftentimes when an immigrant population arrives in an area away from their homeland, they seem to preserve their traditions even more intensely than where they came from. Could you speak to that whole bringing the tradition of Haydn in this case to America and how they were really the first instrument makers along those lines as well to kind of preserve that?
Exactly. And when we look at other Moravian communities, we note in the Moravian diaries and the records that if one wanted to hear the newest and latest music from Europe, you just had to go to a Moravian community. So they heard this music that was new at that time performed within these communities. And so they were very instrumental in preserving all of this wonderful music.
Any reaction through letters or diaries of people hearing this great music for the first time who may not have been aware of Franz Josef Haydn? And I'm sure there were many of them in the early colonial America.
There is documentation for this, particularly in the Pennsylvania communities when, you know, Philadelphia was the capital of the United States before Washington, D.C., and this is very close to where the Moravians were. And so you find these founding fathers actually being present in the Moravian communities listening to
Benjamin Franklin.
Exactly. Yeah. Franklin was listening. Yeah.
That's right. There's a quote in the literature about Ben. His response was
he was impressed.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That really says a lot.
Yeah, it takes a lot to impress Ben Franklin. I mean, my son, Seven, we just read the Ben Franklin biography. It's a cute little book, but I had completely forgotten the impact that guy had in this country. His fingers are everywhere in the forming of the... Oh, that's another story.
Yeah. Well, what blows my mind, too, and this is outside of the Moravian context, but De Ponte, Mozart's librettist, actually came to the United States, left Europe, and lived in New Jersey. And so, you know, you don't think of someone that closely related to Mozart actually living in, when you say New Jersey, it all of a sudden just wrecks your paradigm of all of this kind of, you know, timeline for that. Napoleon's brother came to the United States and was living in New Jersey. You know, this is but that's the period. That colonial, post-colonial period is when you start seeing this this kind of back and forth. And the Moravians were constantly traveling and constantly exchanging their documents. I mean, they were incredible documenters of what their experience, their diaries, and they made multiple copies of these sort of things. They traded them back and forth. They shared them. So as you said, pre-tweet, there still was a real trading of experiences and knowledge between the communities, and that went across the ocean as well. One of my favorites is when I was doing some of the research on Herbst, is you can find an answer to a letter in one library, but you have to go to the other library to find what the original letter was, you know.
Yeah.
So you're trying to match up between Europe and the United States, what these various levels of correspondence were really, what were they talking about, you know, what was the question? I loved one letter between the Pennsylvania community and the North Carolina community when one person was basically knowing they were going to move to the other community and requesting that certain things be planted in the garden there so that when they arrived,
he'd be ready to go.
The garden would be ready to go. And, you know,
how about that?
Fascinating, isn't it?
I imagine that the availability of, because when we look at this time period, just about everyone wrote letters and diaries. Just the richness of the primary source material must have been a draw for you guys.
Exactly. And we have these wonderful music manuscripts of Herbst that we're going to see as part of our symposium. We're going to go to the vaults at the Moravian Music Foundation to view these items. It's just really quite impressive.
What do you get from your all's perspective? Because you're, in addition to being performers, you're music scholars, looking at the original manuscript. Scott, give me an example of something you get from that experience as a researcher that you really can't just seeing it printed up on Sibelius or whatever program they're using.
Exactly. Well, you see this wonderful manuscript and beautiful handwriting. Perfect notation. It really does take you back in time. I think as a performer, you look at this and it just gives you a greater sense of connection.
And I'm going to throw you this, Tim. Don't take offense, but I mean, from the outsider looking in, who's not embedded in this music and really invested in the Moravian culture, they would say, "Ah, Herbst, Merbst. I mean, what is it about this guy? You know, it sounds like another Franz Josef Haydn to me. What was it about his output specifically that drew you to his music?"
Yeah, it's a good question. I found that Herbst was a very creative composer. I mean, lots of ideas. The work that I've spent a lot of time on is his Hymns to be Sung at the Pianoforte, which was really a pedagogical collection of his compositions and other compositions that he had gathered from Moravians and non-Moravians, America and Europe, in which he was actually teaching the young ladies in the school system, the Moravian school, in their care. He was teaching them how to play piano, but also he was teaching them Moravian theology at the same time. And I think that kind of combination of what is really a high art in music composition and then pairing that with their theological needs to kind of perpetuate the thinking within the church, that combination at a high level was striking to me.
My thanks to Executive Director of the American Choral Directors Association, Dr. Tim Sharp, and Old Salem Organist and Coordinator of Music Programming, Scott Carpenter. Going on this weekend at Old Salem, it'll be Gardening with Children on Saturday morning, June 1st from 10 to 11 at the Single Brothers Workshop, 10 West Academy Street in Old Salem. And don't forget the Old Salem Cobblestone Farmers Market Saturday mornings from 9 to noon through November 23rd at the intersection of West and Salt Streets. It's a tradition at Old Salem that dates back more than 200 years. You'll find more information on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, it's time for another short break, and when we return, we'll get romantic with pianist Peter Karoff. That's right, it'll be time for Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard and his take on the romantic period in music. Then we'll dive headfirst into the wonderful world of books with Bethany Chafin. She talks to fellow book lover and award-winning local author Charlie Lovett about his new novel, The Bookman's Tale, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is a little old segment we like to call Karoff at the Keyboard.
Today I'd love to talk with you about a period in music history we call the Romantic Era. It's basically the 19th century, from about 1800 until about 1900. That word romantic is a little bit unusual, actually. Romantic, in modern sense, we think, oh, isn't it romantic? It's all about love. But the word romantic actually has a broader sense in this context. It comes actually from the French roman, which is the French word for a novel. And so when we say this music is romantic, we're saying that it is literary. It's like today we say, wow, isn't it just like the movies? It's so intense. Well, back then they said, isn't it like a book? It's so intense. So we can understand this music through the 19th century as being deeply influenced by and inspired by literature. So, for example, here's a piece by Felix Mendelssohn. It's from one of his Songs Without Words. Well, it's beautiful. It has a melody. It has an accompaniment. So in its expression and in its rich harmonies, yes, it's romantic. It's characteristic of the 19th century. But there's another layer to this piece. Mendelssohn calls it the Venetian boat song. And so suddenly we're invited to imagine not just that it's a melody and an accompaniment, but it's also a scene, a story. There's a boatman, and we're in Venice, and we're in a gondola, and the melody in the right hand is now a gondolier singing, and the accompaniment in the left hand is not just beautiful harmonies, but the rocking waves of the boat as we sit in the gondola. The music's so beautiful and so filled with emotion that we're tempted to imagine a story that's being told. What is happening here? Well, the answer to that question most of the time is simply this. That is to say, what's happening is the notes. And yet, in the Romantic era in the 19th century, people were constantly telling stories through sound. Overtly or less overtly, but nevertheless, there is a kind of literary component to so much of the instrumental music of this period. Another important component we see in the 19th century was a move towards instrumental virtuosity. That's a fancy word. It just means requiring more from performers. A virtuoso is simply someone who's really good at their instrument or their voice. And so virtuosity demands a richer and grander approach to the keyboard and to the other instruments than was required before. You can hear those rich harmonies, the dramatic movements of the melodies going here and there. Powerful use of the instrument, this kind of virtuosity. So whether it's a simple piece like the Mendelssohn we heard earlier, a thick, powerful, and virtuosic work like this piece by Johannes Brahms, a quiet and thoughtful interlude like this one by Schumann, they're all perfect examples of this musical romanticism, seemingly telling a story through sound, pushing the emotional content so that we feel what the composer is trying to express. We feel those moments of pathos and of passion and of joy. Quite often these works require an extensive ability, a technical ability, so that the instruments are used in a much more flashy way. Musical romanticism.
Wake Forest University professor and Steinway artist, Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And since the Romantic era composers drew so heavily on literature for inspiration, our associate producer Bethany Chafin thought it might be nice to pay tribute to that wonderful muse with a close-up look at the world of books. Winston-Salem-based author Charlie Lovett is a former antiquarian bookseller, current book collector, and published author. His newest novel, published by Penguin,
and titled The Bookman's Tale went on sale this week. With romance, crime, art, historical figures, and a centuries-old literary relic, The Bookman's Tale has it all. For listeners in the Piedmont, you'll find plenty of local inspiration in this new novel, and you can hear Charlie Lovett June 3rd at 7 o'clock as Bookmarks and Summit School host a book release party in the Loma Hopkins Theater of Summit School. Charlie joined Bethany in the studios of WFDD, and he began by sharing his personal collection of Lewis Carroll books.
It started out really for me on rainy afternoons listening to this long-playing records of Cyril Richard reading Alice in Wonderland and when I was a child. And also with this idea that my father, he collected Robinson Crusoe, and so I had this idea that not only would book collecting be fun, but that collecting a single title would be something that would be a way to organize a collection. And so as a young man, I got interested in, I thought I would collect Alice in Wonderland. And at that time, I didn't know anything about Lewis Carroll or the world that he lived in or anything of that sort. And over the years, as I learned more about him and more about Victorian England and the people that he knew and the books that he read and the plays that he went to, my collection's really grown to be sort of Lewis Carroll and his world. And yes, I do have a lot of editions of Alice in Wonderland, but the parts of the collection that I like the most, I think, are the ones that sort of put the life of this very interesting and multifaceted character into a broader context, and you can see how he interacted with other writers and with other people and with his students and with the world of theater and the world of art and the world of literature. So that's been really a rewarding way to pursue collecting for me, is to sort of gradually broaden my idea of what a book collection can be. The shelves in my house may not appreciate the fact that I've broadened it quite that much, but for me it's been fun.
What advice do you have for someone who is looking to start collecting? Does it start with one book, or does it start with too many books? And then you decide, you know, I have all these books, and I'm going to continue growing and turn this, you know, take it from a bookshelf to a library. I'm sure it's different for everyone, but do you have any advice you'd give?
I think it is different for everyone. I think for a lot of people, they don't start collecting. They just realize that they already are collecting. But certainly for a lot of us, there's that moment. I mean, for me, it happened when I was on my honeymoon in London, and we were toying with the idea of collecting Lewis Carroll, and we went into this one shop and said, "Do you have any Alice in Wonderland books?" And the guy went downstairs and came up with like two big boxes full of books that were fairly inexpensive. You know, they're just all these editions of Alice. And it was very much a fish or cut bait sort of moment. You know, it's like, okay, we're either going to buy all of this stuff or we're not going to buy any of it. And we bought all of it. So I think for some people there is that moment, but for others you just sort of look around your house and go, "Oh, I'm a book collector." And one of the things that's nice about book collecting, too, is unlike, for instance, collecting, you know, fine antiques or 19th century paintings or something like that, is you can really do it on almost any budget. There are so many books out there and so many different ways that they can be assembled into collections that, you know, it doesn't have to be something that requires a huge amount of money or even a huge amount of space necessarily.
Now, you use the term marginalia, and I was wondering, you know, I don't know if all of our listeners would be familiar with what exactly that means. I'm sure they could guess, but I was wondering if you could talk about that and whether or not you see your book as a form of marginalia.
Well, it's funny that you should hone in on that word, because when I was working on The Bookman's Tale, that was actually my working title, Marginalia, and we ended up not using that title for the very reason that you say, that probably a lot of people might not be familiar with that word. It's a slightly esoteric word, and it didn't seem as friendly and inviting a title. But marginalia, simply put, is simply things that are written in the margins. And with The Bookman's Tale, the most obvious example of marginalia is this Shakespearean artifact that Peter finds. It's a book that was a source for Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale. And it has all these jottings in the margin that appear to be written by William Shakespeare, but then maybe not. And part of the adventure that Peter goes through is trying to find out, before the bad guys catch him or the good guys catch him. He's in that sort of Hitchcockian situation of he's been framed for a murder, but the murderer is also after him, and he has to try to figure out if this thing is real or if it's a forgery. But I think there's also in the book a broader notion of marginalia, in that at the beginning, Peter is really living at the margins of life. He's in such denial about his grief that he's just not interacting with people. He's sort of hiding. And the book is sort of about his journey from the margins back into the text of life, if you will. I think that's sort of his character arc. So yeah, it works on a lot of different levels in terms of thinking about. And if you're one of those readers who looks for recurring words throughout a text, you'll see that I use the word marginalia and the word margins in a lot of different contexts in the book, because I really wanted to play with that idea of what happens on the edge and what happens in the middle, both of a book and of a person's life.
That brings up the question of your writing process itself and how you structured this book. Did you write all of these stories at the same time? Did you sort of write them separately and then learn how you were going to weave them together? What did that process look like?
For me, this particular book was both a rapid process and a drawn-out process. That is to say, the first ideas about this book, the first notes that I put down on paper happened in 2005. But it was 2008 when I actually sat down to write the first draft. So I'd been kind of cogitating on ideas and writing down notes for, you know, 2 or 3 years. But then I wrote the whole first draft in about 4 months. I tend to write a first draft pretty quickly. I tend to find a time when I know I can set aside, you know, several hours a day, most days a week, for a 3 or 4 month period and sit down and crank out a first draft pretty fast. And then you go into the work of revision. In the cases of juggling the three timelines in this book, in the first draft, I just sort of wrote what I felt like I needed to write. So yeah, I was working on all three of them at once, and I was exploring the ideas of the connections between the different timelines, so that when Peter in the front line is worrying about whether or not the book is a forgery, in the middle line, he's learning something about literary forgery from his mentor in the Rare Book Room, and in the historical part, maybe we're talking about a historic forger. So there's sort of points of connection. Some of them are less subtle and some of them are more subtle. And those I really teased out in later drafts. At that point, I didn't really work with an outline as I was writing until I get about halfway through. And then I would write an outline of what's left and I would keep changing that. But on the last edit, I did make an outline of every scene in the book. And then I cut them up into little slips of paper and literally had them spread out over this table and was constantly like rearranging. And we wanted to combine some of the sections in that final edit so that the reader would stay grounded in each particular time period a little bit longer. But there was also this need for the reader to find out information in a certain order and to maintain these thematic connections. So it was a juggling act. It was fun. I mean, I really enjoyed that part because at some point it becomes a puzzle. And I think we ended up with a book that flows pretty well from time period to time period.
Peter finds this beautiful Victorian watercolor in a book as he's perusing a bookstore. Obviously, for many reasons, it strikes a chord with him, and he is taken on this journey afterwards. I'm wondering, you know, what you've found in your searches, in your collecting. Has anything ever fallen out of a book that has just really piqued your interest?
I guess one of the most interesting things I found, I was writing a book about my mother. My mother died when I was very young, and I was writing a book about sort of trying to reconnect with her and find out things about her. And I found in a fairly unexpected place this old beat-up high school French book that had been her French book in high school. And it was filled with marginalia. There were things written on the end papers. But the coolest thing was she had blotted her lipstick on the end papers. And it was still, you know, at this point, well, now I still have this book. It's almost 50 years later. And it's still, you know, bright red on the end papers. So I did like the idea of playing with this notion that, you know, a book is a physical object. A book is a text. But a book can also be a container for something else and something unexpected. And what Peter finds is this watercolor that is obviously 100 or 150 years old and yet looks exactly like his wife who just died a few months ago. And that's what sort of draws him into the mystery of the book and sets the story in motion.
So for your mom, it's almost as if blotting her lipstick there, it was her signature of ownership. I'd like to get your opinion on is this digital age that we're headed into. Mm-hmm. And how does collecting change with this digital age? Because for so long, as you say, you know, the book has been both text, object, story, and everything larger than that yep. It represents. And now we're moving into a time when everyone's library can be contained on an e-reader.
Right.
So how does that change collecting? Do you see collecting living on, becoming more important? What are some of your thoughts on?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I mean, you can't open an e-reader and have a Victorian watercolor fall out of it. I can't show you an e-reader that has a long inscription by Lewis Carroll on the front page, or that has marginalia written on it by William Shakespeare. So there are certain things that a physical book can do that a digital book will never really be able to do. And there, a lot of those things are the things that we talk about in the Bookman's Tale, the emotional connection you can have with a previous owner, the way you can feel the book as a physical object and an object of beauty. So I think there will always continue to be a place in the world for physical books. I think that place may change. It may get smaller. It may not. I like to use an e-reader when I'm traveling. I'm not anti-e-reader. But if it's a book I love, I love to have a hardback copy of it sitting on my shelf. And wow, if it's a hardback copy that's signed by the author, so much the better, because you know that can be another kind of connection that I can have. It's a little bit difficult to have with an e-reader. There are people who are coming up with ideas for how do you deal with a book signing when it's an e-reader? Do you take a digital picture of yourself with the author and those sorts of things? But when I hold a book, for instance, that belonged to my grandfather when he was a child and that has his name sort of scrawled in it in his childish handwriting, and I think about the fact that, you know, he sat down and read that very book and had a reaction to those words in that physical object, I can't imagine having the same feeling just picking up an e-reader and reading it, because an e-reader really is just mostly about text. It's not about a physical object or a container or these other things that we've talked about. I can't imagine having that same emotional reaction to just reading the same text of that book on an e-reader. So I hope people will think about that, that will think about what books do you want to pass to your children or to your grandchildren, maybe in a physical form as opposed to just knowing that they'll have access to it in a digital form, that might give them a richer connection with you and with your life and with your past and with previous generations. So I hope there'll always be a place for physical books for some of those reasons.
Charlie Lovett, local author of the newly released The Bookman's Tale. He spoke with our associate producer, Bethany Chafin. Barnes & Noble has selected Charlie's novel as a 2013 Recommends title. You can hear Charlie on June 3rd as Bookmarks and Summit School present a book release event in the Loma Hopkins Theater at Summit School. The event begins at 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. Well, that's all for today's show. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, Triad Arts, and Care Off at the Keyboard on our website, wfdd.org. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, associate producer Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Kathleen Coker. We'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.